Drama on One.
Sundays at 8 p.m.
rte.ie/drama on one.
Drama on One.
Drama on One is offered as a podcast at rte.ie/drama on one and, of course, here on RTE Radio 1 on Sunday nights. Tonight, the first episode in a new Drama on One strand, The Burning Question, presented by Louise Williams. The Burning Question is a compendium of thoughts and stories on climate activism. Combining interviews, archive and dramatised excerpts, the programme looks for hope in a time of frightening harm to the planet, in the eloquence of activists, court challenges, new thinking and immersive recordings of the natural world. With actors Imogen Allen, Hannah Brady and Percy Chambaruka, author Philippe Sands, activist Lauren MacDonald, wildlife recordist Chris Watson, lawyers Jerry Liston and Garrod O'Quinn, and musical score by Dara Jukes. This is The Burning Question, Episode 1, From the Boardroom to the Courtroom.
This is an emergency.
And we are not going to stand by. We feel a bit like broken records.
My message to the older generation.
This is an emergency.
We have been repeating the same message over and over again.
We're here to raise some questions, burning questions. Like, why are young people's fears about the climate emergency not getting a proper hearing?
We are here because we are facing an existential crisis. We are in a planetary emergency. And we are not going to stand by and let people lose their lives and livelihood and be forced to become climate refugees when we can do something.
We're making a playlist of powerful voices who are speaking up for the living planet.
Every single one of us is responsible for emissions into the atmosphere of greenhouse gases.
You know, emissions are now being understood in terms of money. Many countries in the global south and indigenous groups in particular take massive issue with this because emissions are damaging the planet. So how could they be understood as a form of property or in a positive way, you know?
The earth is in need of a good lawyer. Could the planet be saved in the courtroom?
The lawyers involved are ultimately, we're like wind turbines, harnessing the wind that is the power of the climate movement.
And we're bending our ears to the natural world in the recordings of Chris Watson.
Last year, I came to your AGM and pleaded with you to stop the development of the Rosebank oil field, and you did not listen. Since then, our climate has continued to spin out of control much faster than before. For the first time, global warming has broken the 1.5 degree limit set by the Paris Agreement for an entire year. Ocean temperatures are not just off the charts. They've set a new record every single day for the past 365 days. You read the same headlines as we do. Scientists are completely horrified by the speed at which our climate is changing and the untold suffering that lies ahead of us. The biggest driver of this is fossil fuels. I no longer feel it is the right approach to plead with you on behalf of the science, which so clearly tells you not to open any new oil and gas fields, because you know this. And yet you don't stop. I have spent a lot of time trying to understand how you justify your actions. But honestly, I really don't think I will ever understand, human to human, how you could continue expanding oil and gas production. Surely you must know that money is not a good enough reason. But you keep taking. In the past year, you made £29 billion in profit. And even then, it's not enough for you. You'll pocket billions more thanks to tax breaks from our government to develop Rosebank, the UK's biggest undeveloped oil and gas field.
We're here for the urgency of the climate emergency. That's where we want to focus these burning questions, to listen deeply to people like activist Lara MacDonald as she faces up to the shareholders of one of the world's biggest energy companies. She is one person standing up to an array of investors who account for their environmental impact through a profit and loss account. The UK government approved the Rosebank oil and gas project in September 2023, despite repeated warnings from the scientific community that fossil fuels need to stay in the ground for a few more million years, at least.
I have spent a lot of time trying to understand how you justify your actions. But honestly, I really don't think I will ever understand, human to human, how you could continue expanding oil and gas production.
We've now come to understand that human activity going back more than two centuries is responsible for causing climate change and global warming. And the beneficiaries of the emissions, the burning of fossil fuels for 200 years of the Industrial Revolution, are those countries which are today the wealthiest countries.
In your inconceivable greed, you cannot see your humanity. So we cannot plead to your humanity.
And so there is an issue of transgenerational justice. There is an aspect of colonial history which is part of this story. And there is an issue of dealing with the whole climate issue in such a way as you take into account historic responsibilities. In other words, it's not just what is country X emitting today. It is, what has country X emitted since 1760?
You read the same headlines as we do. Scientists are completely horrified by the speed at which our climate is changing. And yet you don't stop.
And you can actually work out the emissions of a country's population over 250 years. And that produces a picture which is startling and striking, because it makes it very clear that those who are the most vulnerable today are those who have benefited the least over time from the economic and financial benefits of burning fossil fuels. So there is an equity issue, a very big equity issue, in the climate change debate.
So it's clear to me that in your inconceivable greed, you cannot see your humanity. So we cannot plead to your humanity. Instead, I am here to tell you that we will stand in your way. I am here on behalf of thousands of people across the UK who are committed to opposing you and your oil field. Scientists, faith leaders, politicians, doctors, parents, grandparents, young people, thousands of us.
Perhaps the disjoint between our love of nature and our abuse of it comes about because we're not listening closely enough to nature. We're not hearing the suffering that the earth is trying to communicate. It's alive, after all.
We're seals.
Grey seals of the North Sea.
We were here a long time before you.
Before the Industrial Revolution.
Before seismic testing.
before underwater noise pollution.
Lauren McDonald says, and I quote, if the oil in Rosebank is burnt, it will create more CO2 than 28 entire countries produce in a year combined.
So keep it in the ground.
System change, not climate change.
Don't be a fossil fool.
Stop denying the earth is dying.
System change, not climate change.
I'm Chris Watson. I'm a sound recordist, and I have a particular interest and passion in recording the sounds of wildlife and the natural world. Just a week or so ago, I returned from what was a remarkable recording trip to Zambia in South Luanga by the banks of the River Luanga. It seemed to be this idyllic Eden of a habitat, this mosaic of forests and grassland and riversides and plains. And I was escorted there every day by some guides, particularly a guard who I made good friends with, Patrick, who had to come out because it's very difficult to step outside the vehicle, our Jeep at the time, because the place is full of dangerous animals, basically lions, hyenas, hippos by the riverbank. And so Patrick accompanied me every day, all day, from 4 in the morning, quite often until 7 in the evening, in very close proximity with his rifle slung casually across his shoulder as we ran cables out alongside the river. And so I got to know Patrick really well and conversations about him and his family in particular. But he just said to me casually, we were having breakfast alongside our vehicle by the river one day, and he said, you know, again, for the second year running, the maize crop has failed here, which is the staple food of most of the people that live in the countryside of Zambia. It's becoming not only more difficult to find bags of maize, but the price that's set is going up and up. He just looked at me and he said, you know, we've got a drought again this year. Some days my family have to miss a meal. They don't have a meal in the middle of the day because they can't afford the maize. That is the sharp end of climate change. I mean, for them, the rains have failed. It's not, oh, climate change. You know, it's the rains have failed again. What seems to us, this idyll, we complain about the lack of wildlife because of climate change. At the moment, everything's very rosy there, apart from what's happening to the humans.
Every place in the natural world has a landscape of its own sounds, uninterrupted by the noise of humans or our machines. The natural world's sounds resonate in us, drawing us in, allowing us to connect to the poetics of its space. The boundary between nature and us loosens as we become immersed in sound. Listening is a way of entering a kind of oratory. It allows us to come into relationship with the gift of the natural world. And it is a gift. It's not the property of a corporation or an individual. Law, which is the backbone of how we relate to each other, struggles to find a basis for the rights of nature. And the earth can't give instructions to its lawyer. In Ecuador, nature and its survival are at the heart of the country's constitution. The state in Ecuador can prosecute human actions that put species and ecosystems at risk. In New Zealand, the Whanganui River is the first river in the world that has legal personhood, which means that the river's needs can be at the heart of a prosecution. The river has rights. It can have standing, locus standi, in a court of law. That may put the river's needs ahead of human needs. It's a paradigm shift to prosecute on behalf of the planet rather than on behalf of one of its human inhabitants. If we acknowledge that the living planet is suffering, can we conceive of its protection as our duty of care? It is a big shift to frame law around the rights of nature, but paradigm shifts have happened before.
You know, I mean, I notice it when I'm talking to people, coming back to what we talked about a little earlier, if I talk to people that I'm working on the environment and the protection of the environment, people go, you know, you can sort of see people's eyes glazing over. The moment you say you're working on ecocide, they're, ooh, that sounds interesting. What's that? Tell me more about that. It's the criminalisation of human behaviour that massively and systematically damages the environment. Yes, I'm totally against that. So words really matter.
System change, not climate change.
System change, not climate change.
Don't be a fossil fool.
Don't be a fossil fool.
Stop denying the earth is dying.
Stop denying the earth is dying.
System change, not climate change.
System change, not climate change.
My name is Philippe Sands. I'm a university professor. I'm a barrister. I write books. I became involved in the environment very early in my career. In the 1980s, I was in my late 20s. The Chernobyl accident happened at the nuclear power plant in the Soviet Union, and one thing led to another, and the environmental bug bit me.
Should we talk about ecocide? Could you explain it for us in layperson's terms?
So, one of the areas of international law that has developed the most in the last 60 or 70 years is the area known as international criminal law. It really came of age in 1945, at the time of the famous Nuremberg judgment, the trial of Nazi criminals. And back then and ever since, there have been four international crimes. War crimes, which is essentially the targeting of civilians during war. Crimes against humanity, which is about the protection of individuals. Genocide, which is about the protection of groups. And the crime of aggression, which is about the waging of an illegal war. What's interesting about these four international crimes, which really haven't changed much in the last 75 years since Nuremberg, is that they all focus on the well-being of the human. They do not address, directly or indirectly, the well-being of the natural environment. As far back as 1970, people started talking about a concept called ecocide. The context that got it going was the use of a chemical called Agent Orange during the Vietnam War. The Swedish Prime Minister, at the opening of the famous 1972 Stockholm Conference on the Human Environment, a UN conference, evoked the notion of ecocide, a future in which international criminal law protects not only human beings, but the environment. A British barrister called Polly Higgins began about 15 years ago to pursue the idea that we need a fifth international crime.
And give it a name, call it an ecocide. And when we do that, then the healing truly can begin. So this is about using law, bringing law back to reinstate the sacred trust of civilization. Because when we do that, then we start to take responsibility individually and collectively.
Well, when we were drafting the definition of ecocide, we wanted to find a way of, if you like, capturing the notion of recklessness. So doing something without turning your mind to the terrible consequences for the environment that might follow. If I authorise a new coal mine, if I authorise the exploitation of a new oil field in the North Sea, if I cut down hundreds of millions of trees in a particular part of the world, am I at risk of being called to account for the crime of ecocide? I mean, it's the same in relation to war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. Proving those things in court, the prosecutor's role, means looking at what people do, why and how they do it, and in particular, whether they turned their minds to the consequences of their actions. That's bread and butter stuff for a prosecutor. There was an incident some years back where a British company called Trafigura dumped massive quantities of highly toxic wastes into a human environment in the Côte d'Ivoire. They knew exactly what they were doing. They knew exactly what the consequences were going to be. And to my mind, that's not difficult to prove. You can't put a corporation in prison. All you can do is impose a fine on a corporation. They pay the fine and they just carry on. I think nothing concentrates the mind more than the fear of a tap on the shoulder and the possibility that you may end up doing time. You focus on the chief executive officers, the chief operating officers, the chief financial officers, maybe the largest shareholders, and you focus on those individuals. You don't need to focus on the corporations. It's very obvious that, you know, fossil fuels is at the heart of climate change, and if climate change is going to be part of the ecocide framework, then those individual executives who take a decision to engage in a particular activity, in my view, ought to know that they are at risk of criminal investigation. Equally, those politicians who grant licenses. One aspect that I thought was just outrageous: the United Kingdom authorising a new coal mine, the United Kingdom giving out hundreds of licenses just in, you know, very recent period for new oil exploitation in the North Sea. To my mind, the politicians who decided on those things should know or should have been instructed that they are at risk of individual criminal liability for engaging in those kinds of acts. It's as simple as that. That really concentrates the mind.
Surely you must know that money is not a good enough reason. But you keep taking.
Ecocide. Think of it as a crime against future generations. Wouldn't it focus the mind to see captains of industry standing trial for ecocide? Could this be the jolt that's needed to put a halt to the ongoing damage to the planet? We shouldn't need a jolt. After all, we love this world around us in its natural abundance. Don't we? It's 2020. Young activists are no longer able to gather in huge crowds for Fridays for Future, so they switch to online meetups. A screen divided into squares with tinny microphones may lack charisma, but it was the only channel available for activists to gather during the pandemic.
Thank you, Claudia. And now we hand over to Katerina.
We're joining an online press conference organised by Global Legal Action Network, or GLAN, led by Irish lawyers Garrod O'Quinn.
They experienced a new temperature record of 40.
Jerry Liston.
So you've just heard about how climate change is already impacting the lives.
And lead counsel Mark Willers.
We're seeking a ruling from the European Court of Human Rights in this case that states are obliged to adopt emission cuts that are collected.
My name is Garrod O'Quinn, director of GLAN, the Global Legal Action Network. In 2017, we began working with a committed group of young people from Portugal who wanted to take a stand on the climate crisis.
Katerina, Claudia, Martim, Mariana, Sofia, and Andre.
They were responding to the worst forest fires in living memory, fires which ripped through forests, homes, and resulted in the deaths of 120 people.
And police believe a lightning strike may have started the fire.
This disaster brought the reality of climate change home. It was now on their doorstep, and they were acutely aware that their present and future well-being were being put in jeopardy. This was the starting point of a conversation that set in motion an ambitious legal case against multiple European states whose emissions are directly harming their lives. Today, they are filing what is an unprecedented case against 33 countries with the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg.
Once the case gets to court, the needs of these young people will be voiced by adults. But they're well able to speak up for themselves outside of the courtroom, at online gatherings aimed at drumming up support for their case.
Thank you, and I will now hand over to Claudia in Leiria.
Sou Claudia, tenho 21 anos.
I'm Claudia. I'm 21 years old. I'm from Leiria, and I'm a nursing student. I decided to participate in this case because climate change is the biggest threat to my future and to that of my generation. I grew up in the countryside, and that's probably why I like to be in open spaces and why I feel free when I'm in nature. In 2017, I witnessed in horror the deadly forest fires that destroyed several areas of the country, including the region of Leiria. Fortunately, neither myself nor my family and friends were directly affected. But it was overwhelming for me to see how the forests, where I usually like to be, suddenly became extremely dangerous places.
At that moment, I clearly understood that climate change is making the world an increasingly dangerous place, and that my generation is increasingly vulnerable and without future prospects. The crisis triggered by COVID-19 reminds us that as a species, we're very vulnerable. We must learn from this situation and recognize that we, especially my generation, are at risk of not having the means to live or even to survive.
The truth is that climate change is a public health crisis. Our health depends on the health of our environment. We know that natural catastrophes and extreme heat waves will kill increasingly more people. So we must emerge from the COVID-19 crisis with much more resilience than before. And we need a healthy recovery. For that, it's not enough to recognize that a climate emergency exists. If governments truly want to restore public health, they need to act immediately and with the urgency science attests. It is absolutely clear a healthy recovery requires radical action against climate change. Thank you.
And so, this group of six young people have asked the European Court of Human Rights to recognise their suffering as a violation of their human rights, including the right to life, protected by Article 2 of the European Convention on Human Rights.
Put bluntly, climate change affects the applicant's right to life because it increases their chances of dying prematurely. And that threat to their right to life stands to worsen significantly over the course of their lifetimes.
Hello, everyone. I'm Katerina. I'm 20 years old. I live in a village near Leiria.
Hello,
I'm Sofia. I'm 15 years old and I live in the south of Lisbon.
I live with the feeling that every year my home is becoming an increasingly hostile place.
My brother André suffers from asthma.
And I'm aware that as I grow older, I'll be subject to violent heat waves that will last for several weeks.
If he runs for 5 minutes outdoors when it's very hot, he becomes short of breath and too hot, which worries me a lot because on normal days he's unstoppable.
If I have children, what kind of world will I be bringing them into?
Sometimes I think if climate change is already so extreme in 2020, how will it be in the near future if we do nothing about it?
These are the real concerns I live with every day.
The case also focuses on a violation of the right to respect for their privacy and their family lives.
It's a right which covers both their physical and mental well-being. You've heard them describe their real, indeed enormous, anxiety about their futures. This impact on their mental well-being is a clear-cut infringement of their Article 8 rights.
And, crucially, that they're not being protected against discrimination on the basis of their youth.
This is because they stand to experience the worst effects of climate change for the obvious reason that they will live longer. Our case is that European governments are wrongly discriminating against the youth applicants by failing to properly tackle the climate emergency with the required degree of urgency. There's no justification for European governments to force them and other young people to bear this burden.
System change, not climate change.
We had 43 degrees Celsius this year.
Don't be a fossil fuel.
That is extremely hot.
Stop denying the earth is dying.
It was hotter than Dubai.
System change, not climate change.
I'm trying to build my life, to go to school and to study, but it is hard to concentrate in such heat. It is hard to sleep, and then it is hard to study again. It impacts on my whole life.
We have another question on social media. Why are you attacking countries, especially countries that are trying to take measures to reduce their emissions? I might pass this one to Andre.
What I feel, and what we all feel, is that the whole world is in danger, including the countries that claim that we're attacking them. We're not attacking them, not at all. We're giving countries the opportunity to do more and better regarding the commitments they made, that is, to reduce the impact of climate change. It's an opportunity we're giving all of them, not an attack.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, climate change has got to go.
Fast forward 3 years to the hearing of the case at the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. It's September 2023. The benches of the court are lined with intent faces. Many are wearing headphones to listen to the lawyer's arguments in translation.
On one side of the aisle, six young people from Portugal, and on the other, the 32 governments and their legal teams, we estimate in excess of 87 lawyers pushing back against them.
La Cour.
I declare open the public hearing on the admissibility and merits in the case of Duarte, Agostinho and others against Portugal and 32 other states.
The stakes are very high for the 32 countries, including all member states of the European Union, plus five other states. If the case against them is successful, they will each be obliged to tackle their emissions, as well as their exports of fossil fuels, and to do it for real, rather than just pledge to do it. Because of the war, Ukraine is no longer a defendant in the case. Sudhanshu Swarup speaks for the defendant states.
Madam President, distinguished judges, the respondent states understand full well the gravity of the fight against climate change. But the foundational principles of the convention system of human rights protection must be applied and respected, regardless of the nature of the issue before the court.
The defendant states, well, they tend to focus on the technicalities, whether we've ticked all the right boxes to make our case, the points of entry, the admissibility criteria.
The applicants, in reality, are asking the court to build a new model of extraterritorial jurisdiction, contrary to legal principle, and with the effect that any person on the planet who claims to be affected by climate change could claim to be within the jurisdiction of each and every one of the respondent states.
Similarly, they're also trivializing the claims of the applicants. So to give you an example of this, Ireland is the only country to explicitly say that the risks which these Portuguese people face is no greater than the risks of living day to day in a modern city. They've completely trivialized the reality that they're already experiencing and focusing on the technical elements.
Secondly, this application has been brought directly to this court without any attempt to invoke, let alone exhaust, domestic remedies anywhere.
Starting with the facts, there is no doubt that global warming is caused by greenhouse gas emissions for which humans are responsible.
Alison MacDonald speaks for the Young Litigants.
And even at the current point of warming, the European Parliament and a number of the respondents have declared climate emergencies. The situation was starkly described by the United Nations Secretary General, Mr. Guterres, in a speech this July. Climate change is here. It is terrifying. The era of global warming has ended. The era of global boiling has arrived. The air is unbreathable, the heat is unbearable, and the level of fossil fuel profits and climate inaction is unacceptable. A report by the World Health Organization, among others, goes so far as to say that environmental threats jeopardize the future for children on our planet.
On a video recording from the courtroom, you can just see the young people sat in a row. They're directly behind their lawyer, Alison MacDonald, who's addressing the court.
Now, in light of all this, there is an overwhelming scientific consensus that the long-term temperature goal must be a rise of under 1.5 degrees. So, what is required to achieve this? Here, the scientific consensus says deep and rapid cuts in emissions, including fossil fuel production, starting immediately. The urgency of deep cuts is brought home by the latest emissions gap report of the UN Environment Programme, which warns that a continuation of current policies would result in up to 3.3 degrees of warming this century. Now, none of this is politics. It is science.
Climate change is a global challenge, and there is already a global treaty regime for dealing with that challenge. That regime requires international cooperation. The applicant's attempt to impose a parallel regime just for the respondent states, but without the consent of the respondent states, risks undermining that international process. In short, the applicants are asking the court to act as legislators rather than judges, and to legislate for a global challenge without having global jurisdiction. The application should be rejected.
Usually a state is sued in the European Court of Human Rights for actions that take place within its sovereign boundaries. The argument made in Strasbourg is calling upon the extraterritorial jurisdiction of the defendant states. In other words, impacts beyond their borders.
1 ton of greenhouse gases from France, say, has the same effect as 1 ton from Portugal. And the science is clear, as we've seen, that these emissions cumulatively increase the extremity of, for example, the heat and fires in Portugal. And in the unique context of climate change, the applicants urge the court not to permit a situation where civilization-threatening harm is being contributed to by the collective acts and omissions of the respondents, but where each of them can escape on the basis of the collective nature of the harm. This court is uniquely well-placed to address these legal issues in the transnational way that climate change requires. In the unique circumstances of this case, this court is, we say, the remedy.
The arguments have concluded, so it's time for the judges to withdraw to give them consideration.
I declare the hearing closed.
Ireland is one of 32 countries being taken to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg today by a group of Portuguese young people who accuse the nations of failing to act on climate change. The Irish government says it's committed to halving greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 and reaching net zero by 2050.
Months pass. It's April 2024. We catch up with lawyer Jerry Liston just a few days before the ruling is expected in Strasbourg.
Yeah, it's hard not to feel nervous. This has been, for me, I've been working on this case for nearly 8 years since it was an idea. And then the ruling will take about 15 minutes to deliver. But yeah, we feel confident in the sense that we've put forward an extremely strong case. That's no guarantee of any outcome, of course. But I don't think the court has ever been presented with as compelling a set of facts as the facts that we presented at the hearing last September. I mean, ultimately, there has never been as great a threat to human rights as the climate crisis. And we really believe the court should step up, but we will find out on Tuesday as to whether it will.
What happens if the court rules against your case? How will you feel? How will it be for you?
Yeah, of course, we'll be very disappointed. There are two other cases being ruled on that were heard in March last year, one brought by a group of Swiss senior women against Switzerland. And even a ruling in that case, for example, would be hugely significant. It would set a precedent against Switzerland that could then be applied to all European countries. So not everything is hinging on our case. If we get the ruling that we're looking for, that would effectively operate like a binding treaty imposed on the government's 32 respondent states by the court. So it would have greater bite on a greater number of states, but still a win in the case brought against Switzerland, or another case brought by a French MEP, Damien Carême, against France would be hugely significant as well. And I'm very confident that the court will deliver a favourable ruling in at least one of the cases.
On the morning of the ruling, Jerry is joined by one of the young applicants, Andre, to speak to journalists.
A win in any of the three cases would be a win for all of us. But no matter what the court decides, nothing will change the fact that European governments need to do so much more to ensure we have a livable future.
The governments haven't contested the fundamental evidence that we rely on in this case. They don't contest with any of their own evidence the dire impacts, including extreme heat waves that are unimaginable even by today's deteriorating standards in Portugal, that the youth applicants will face within their lifetimes if we remain on our current trajectory.
What we see in climate cases around the world, in the domestic system, is that defendants, when they lose, if they're a company or a government, will always appeal. But the European Court verdict is quite unique. There is no way to appeal it because it's the highest court on human rights in Europe. The highest courts in the Netherlands and in Germany have already found that weak climate action can be a breach of human rights.
Then, on the morning of April the 9th, comes the verdict.
The court unanimously, one, decides to strike the application insofar as it concerns Ukraine out of its list of cases. Two, declares the remainder of the application inadmissible.
It's a betrayal beyond words. And today's rulings make very clear that the European states have a legal responsibility to take real climate action and to protect people and to protect its citizens. And this is only the beginning of climate litigation. All over the world, more and more people are taking their government to court, holding them responsible for their actions. This means that we have to fight even more, since this is only the beginning. Because in a climate emergency, everything is at stake.
The Portuguese lawsuit was very ambitious in that it tried to hold 32 separate governments to account, which we've never seen that number of defendants before in any case in the world. And so based on that, the court decided that, well, yes, some countries' greenhouse gas emissions do have harms in countries and other countries and affect citizens outside their borders. That wasn't enough to justify new extraterritorial obligations on the courts.
Eventually, a case of this kind will succeed at the European Court of Human Rights, and it will lead to more rulings that protect the natural world and its human inhabitants from the impact of emissions. These rulings will build into a body of legal precedent that will protect the Earth, a sort of Earth jurisprudence, which will protect future generations, eventually. The rejection of the case at Strasbourg is a disappointment for the applicants and for their lawyers as well, who produced thousands of pages of arguments, press releases, online mobilisation and campaigning. But in amidst the disappointment, there's space for a little piece of optimism. Buried deep in this mountain of text and legalese produced for the court, we can dig out an earlier piece of testimony. Here's Sophia when she spoke at that first press conference back in 2020.
This year I'll be attending the 10th grade, and I've chosen to study natural sciences. I recently discovered green chemistry, and I became very interested in that area, where you can deliver new materials and components to help us quit fossil fuels once and for all, and leave them where they should be, underground for a few more million years. Because now it's time to stop emissions and to build alternatives that help to heal the planet, instead of increasingly putting ourselves in danger. For that to happen, we need the help of our governments so we can actually do something practical. My message is simple. I believe that together we're stronger and our voices become more powerful. There is still hope.
In the case of a lawsuit brought forward by more than 2,000 elderly Swiss women, the court ruled that Switzerland had violated some of their human rights by not taking sufficient action on climate change. This is the first time that we've seen a ruling like that in any regional human rights court in the world. They were arguing that they were at greater risk of dying during a heat wave because women and older people are thought to be more affected by rising temperatures. So this precedent will adhere to all 46 signatories of the European Convention on Human Rights. So even though the Portuguese youth didn't win their case, if they were to then sue just Portugal in their own court, this case could serve as precedent for them too. So it has a really wide-ranging implications for similar litigation that's being brought forward across Europe, and at the same time for similar litigation that's being brought forward around the world.
This is the biggest story in the world.
We have the unfathomably great opportunity to be alive at the most decisive time in the history of humanity.
The time has come for us to tell this story, and perhaps even change the ending.
You've been listening to The Burning Question, Drama on One's new strand on climate activism and the living planet. The programme was written and narrated by Louise Williams. Dramatic scenes were performed by Percy Chambaruka, Imogen Allen and Hannah Brady. You also heard the voices of activist Lauren MacDonald, author Philippe Sands, wildlife recordist Chris Watson, lawyers Jerry Liston and Garrod O'Quinn of Global Legal Action Network, writer and UCD lecturer in planning, environmental law and policy Sinead Mercier, and former president of the European Court of Human Rights, Shifra O'Leary. Special thanks to Katharina, Claudia, Martim, Mariana, Sophia and Andre. The programme featured additional reporting from Gloria Dickey of Reuters and Reuters recordings of Greta Thunberg and other commentators. Wildlife recordings were by Chris Watson. Sound design was by Chris Watson and Ruth Kennington. Sound supervision was by Ruth Kennington and Tom Norton. The musical score was by Dara Dukes. The Burning Question was produced by Kevin Brew. The series producer of Drama on One is Kevin Reynolds. Webcasts of hearings at the European Court of Human Rights are funded by the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs and available on the ECHR website.
Special thanks to International Literature Festival Dublin in facilitating our interview with Philippe Sands. Special thanks also to Professor Kevin Whelan and University of Notre Dame Dublin for the use of rooms in O'Connell House for the interview with Philippe. The Burning Question returns in the new year. To listen back to the programme or share it with friends, you can find The Burning Question and the entire Drama on One archive at rte.ie/drama-on-one. The Burning Question is funded by Cumasún na mBean with the television licence fee.
rte.ie/drama-on-one.